Hello, I'm Nigel Cassidy, and this is Business Matters on the BBC World Service. In this hour, investors click like as Facebook rings up unexpectedly strong earnings. But we ask, can it repair its reputation so easily?
This chief financial officer was asked, are these scandals that keep coming up in the media actually hitting how users feel about your platform? And he said, you know, I think the numbers speak for themselves.
The US Central Bank signals it's in no hurry to raise interest rates. Our correspondent reads the Federal Reserve's all-important small print. We celebrate the clattery delights of the typewriter, and we're in the wake of the polar vortex that's frozen the US Midwest to the bone. That's Business Matters here on the BBC. But first, here's the latest world news.
I'm Stuart McIntosh with the BBC News. Hello. President Trump has telephoned Venezuela's opposition leader, Juan Guaido, to assure him of US support. As people across the country heeded Mr. Guaido's call to hold peaceful protests, Washington's new special envoy for Venezuela, Elliot Abrams, outlined increasing pressure on President Nicolas Maduro. Barbara Plett-Usher has the details.
Elliot Abrams told journalists there would be coordinated international efforts to get more humanitarian funding to the opposition. Some of that, he said, would come from Venezuelan government assets, which the U.S. has frozen here. And it was searching the world for other bank accounts and gold deposits, he said. The economic pressure is also aimed at persuading the Venezuelan military to switch sides, without which the opposition movement cannot succeed. So far, the military has stood by Nicolas Maduro, but Mr. Abrams said it was clear there were divisions, and he thought those at the top were nervous.
There have been further indications of the economic damage wrought by Britain's decision to leave the European Union. The Society of Motor Manufacturers and Traders said investment in the car industry had fallen nearly 80% over the past 3 years, while production last year dropped to its lowest level since 2012. The society blamed uncertainty. Barclays Bank is moving more than $200 billion of assets to Ireland because it can no longer wait to implement its Brexit contingency plan. Facebook posted record quarterly profits in the final quarter of 2018, nearly $6.9 billion. Its total profit for the year reached $22 billion. The figures caused Facebook shares to soar in after-hours trading. Here's our North America technology reporter, Dave Lee.
For Facebook, 2018 saw the Cambridge Analytica scandal, political manipulation, fake news, data breaches, and accusations of deeply unethical behaviour. Despite this, the company's profits for the year increased by 39%. The site said that on average it made $7.37 from each of its users. In the face of severe turbulence, Mark Zuckerberg's company has proven to be resilient. While users appear to be turning something of a blind eye, the same won't be said for regulators. Facebook knows huge fines are likely to be coming its way.
Saudi Arabia says it's ended its anti-corruption drive that was launched dramatically more than a year ago with the rounding up of hundreds of princes, billionaires and business leaders. The Saudi news agency says more than $100 billion worth of assets, including property and cash, has been recouped by the state. A court in Chile has jailed six people for involvement in the murder of the former president, Eduardo Frei, in 1982. It follows a 15-year investigation in which Mr. Frei's body was exhumed twice. Four doctors received lengthy sentences for administering poison after a surgical intervention. This is the World News from the BBC.
Hello, and you're very welcome to Business Matters. I'm Nigel Cassidy. Great to have your company. So what are we going to be talking about? Well, good financial times for Facebook, but as we'll be discovering, the social media giant may find it a bit harder to rebuild its reputation than its finances. Also in this hour, how Wall Street's celebrating a change of tone on interest rates as the US Federal Reserve puts rate rises on the back burner. As that polar vortex all but shuts down a string of Midwest US cities, we talk weather, considering the inconsistency of downloadable weather apps. Are forecasts based on just data, or are they a point of view? And we hit return, why typewriters are on the way back.
Computers, they've got no character, have they? They just sort of sit there. But these you can put a piece of paper in and type away.
A As always, we've two guests who chew over these and other stories. From their point of view, there's environmentalist and lawyer Maya Van Rossum, director of the Delaware Riverkeeper Network in New York. A very good evening to you.
Good evening.
And Dr. David Kuo, the CEO of the Motley Fool in Singapore. Good morning.
Salamat pagi, Nigel.
I thought you might say that. More from the two of them very shortly. But let's kick off with Facebook, which has had a tricky couple of years, having to answer repeated questions about how it handles its customer data and protects their privacy. So it was a welcome change for the company to be able to report some good news in the form of strong profits and revenues for the last 3 months, enough to boost the shares 7% in after-hours trading. But don't think this will necessarily make life easier for the global social media giant. Many questions remain unanswered about the controls it has in place and how it'll check and moderate content posted on its platforms, so-called fake news or otherwise. Well, Sarah Fryer is a Bloomberg correspondent in New York who follows the company closely. She told me the figures were at least better than forecast.
The fourth quarter is always a major quarter for Facebook because of the holiday season. And I think that the results here are really just an indication of how big they are and how powerful it is to be that big. They have all the advertisers who really don't have a better alternative for where they can spend their advertising dollars. And unless the users start to leave Facebook, which it looks like they're not, they're actually still growing in user base. Unless the users start to leave Facebook, it is still where the advertisers want to spend their money.
The biggest main, best-known platform is slightly less popular in developed markets. So if the growth is 9%, where are all these new users starting to become customers?
Well, it's interesting. In this quarter, we thought that we'd seen the peak of Facebook in North America and Europe, where their most lucrative advertising partnerships are, but actually we saw an uptick in users, especially in Europe. Of course, the rest of the world had a lot of growth too, but it was interesting to me to see that because we had expected that those markets would be pretty much spoken for.
In the last couple of years, the company has been having to answer a lot of questions about how it handles data and how it treats its users with regard to the privacy of their information. Do you think it's almost embarrassing for the company that it's just powered through these scandals?
I think that, you know, the Dave Wehner, the chief financial officer, was asked, are these scandals that keep coming up in the media actually hitting how users feel about your platform? And he said, you know, I think the numbers speak for themselves. I think there's this attitude at Facebook that real people who use it don't really care about what's happening because they still use Facebook. Now, I would counter that and say that they don't really have many other choices for where to spend their time for that kind of activity. And so in having that much power, I think that we still do need to really look into how Facebook is treating its user base and how it's collecting data. The company just recently got blocked by Apple and using its enterprise apps internally. So Facebook right now has no ability to test products on iOS apps because Apple's retaliating over privacy concerns. So there are real consequences for Facebook's business, for the decisions that they've made about user privacy that they may see more of this year. All of these regulators are looking into them, the Irish Data Protection Commissioner, the Federal Trade Commission in the U.S., and we could see a lot of those consequences start to come a little later.
It's also been reported that they're joining up some of the messenger apps that they control. WhatsApp is the other big one, which is separate from Facebook, and they've got Messenger. What's the significance of that?
So on the earnings call, Mark Zuckerberg said that he wants to integrate behind the scenes Facebook, Messenger, Instagram, and WhatsApp in order to allow users to share messages between those apps and allow them to do it in a way that is very privacy secure. Now, one thing I want to say there is what it will also do is allow Facebook to know who is who on those apps where they maybe are not connecting them to their Facebook profiles. They will have to do a lot more data sharing between them, and regulators are very concerned about what that could mean for user privacy.
Okay, well, Maya Van Rossum's listening there from New York. I'm kind of guessing that Facebook's critics would be happier if it got a bit of a pasting for bad behaviour.
Well, I think it absolutely should get lambasted for its bad behavior. I think, you know, they may have had a growth in the previous year, but the truth is that people are only now, people who use Facebook, particularly the general public and environmental activists, and other activists, whom are the people that I work with, we are all only now really getting a full appreciation of what Facebook has been up to. And so it is really only now I am starting to see the dialogue online, on Facebook and off Facebook, about what do we do about this? You know, how can we trust using this platform for our activism and our outreach? So you know, people do care. This idea that people don't care, they really do care, and it's really starting to emerge. But I think, as your reporter indicated, there aren't other good options right now, but people surely are looking for them.
And I suppose also, Dr. David Kuo, in Singapore, we shouldn't underestimate the importance and interest in Facebook as one of the so-called fangs. I mean, it's an incredibly highly watched company, I mean, irrespective of what it might have been doing to upset people.
Oh, you're absolutely right, Nigel. And I think, you know, when you have the most popular shopping mall in town, every retailer wants to be there. And I think, you know, this is the situation with Facebook. There is no viable alternative to Facebook. So therefore, advertisers have to go there because they know that that is where the eyeballs are. But ultimately, I mean, Facebook needs to remain relevant. And using that shopping mall analogy, if a better shopping mall comes up and it is more attractive, then, of course, you know, the retailers, the shopkeepers will all move to this new shopping mall. And I think this is really the problem that Facebook has. Now, taking that analogy to its extreme, now, if the regulators, and in this case, it could be the traffic wardens who make it very difficult for cars to park in that area, then, of course, it no longer becomes relevant. And I think this really is the problem that Facebook faces. The regulators are after Facebook. They know that there are some concerns about it. They know that people, and Maya is right, I mean, people are a little bit concerned about Facebook, about, you know, what kind of data they're giving to Facebook. If they start holding back, then, of course, you know, Facebook will find it very difficult to monetize these people. And that is when you start seeing revenue starting to fall and the advertisers no longer being interested in advertising on Facebook.
And just briefly, Maya, I suppose it's also true that it isn't immediately obvious to most people exactly how Facebook makes its money. There's no transparency because content comes from third parties and all kinds of different ways that they bring in revenue.
Yeah, I think that that's a very good observation. People really don't understand. But as we're starting to have the news emerge, right, and as we've seen hearings in front of Congress from Mark Zuckerberg, I think people are starting to get a real sense of how their information has been abused, how Facebook makes its money. And one of the ways that it's been making its money is by inappropriately sharing the private information that people entrusted to Facebook. It's really quite shocking. And I think people, again, are just now starting to really come to terms with it and are looking for other options, especially people who are trying to get to do organizing online, like the environmental community and other communities. A lot of people really rely on Facebook and are increasingly frightened from doing so, you know, now and into the future.
Okay, Maya, well, thank you for that. I'm back with you and David Kuo a bit later. But we're going to stay in New York, if you like, where the financial news comes from, because you might not think telling the financial markets you're going to do nothing at all could get anybody excited. But that was the case in the United States. The US Central Bank, which sets interest rates, that's the Federal Reserve, has now officially changed its economic tune. Its longstanding policy of being ready to raise the cost of borrowing is now out. The Fed chairman, Jerome Powell, now says the bank will be patient. And it's made a start by keeping rates just where they are, between 2.25% and 2.5%. As we'll hear, share prices soared in a bit of a relief rally on Wall Street. As a result, of course, higher rates mean more expensive borrowing for businesses, so they're pleased that they're not going up. Well, the BBC's economics correspondent, Andrew Walker, watched Mr. Powell's news conference and told me more.
What we've got in this latest meeting is no change in the actual policy stance as such, but the statement they've issued gave a number of clues to suggest that they are a little bit more concerned about the economic outlook and therefore less likely to raise interest rates, certainly less likely to do it in a great hurry. So just to give you some examples of what was in this new statement, they have dropped the suggestion that they think further gradual increases will be consistent with their economic objective. They've dropped the suggestion that risks to the economic outlook are roughly balanced. They've added the word muted in relation to inflation pressures, so less concern there that inflation might pick up and need preemptive interest rate rises to nip it in the bud, as it were. And they've also added an indication that they will be patient, is the word, when they decide what to do about further rises in interest rates.
Well, we're glad you've read the small print there, so we don't have to. But is this in any way a kind of elegant or even inelegant about turn for the Fed? Because, of course, we know that President Trump and Wall Street really wanted a change here.
I wouldn't call it an about turn. It's more a softening of their position. They still think that the US economy is most likely to continue growing strongly, but they're just more sensitive to risks to that outlook. The phrase that Jerome Powell, the Fed chairman, used in his press conference was cross currents, things that might make that expectation of reasonably strong growth turn out to be wrong.
He also had something to say about the balance sheet of the central bank, the Federal Reserve. Is this about all that bond buying, the QE, which they and other central banks did to try and keep the economies going?
Yes, it is. So the Fed did indeed, when its interest rates were at zero, try to provide further stimulus by buying government bonds and assets based on mortgages, home loans. As some of those bonds mature, as they come due for repayment, it's allowing the value of its total holdings to gradually decline over time. He did say that the Fed is likely to end up having a relatively large balance sheet, even once this process is over, which suggests that it's not going to go as far in reversing its quantitative easing as it might otherwise have done.
Now, finally, Andrew, America's just come out of the longest partial shutdown in its history. President Trump's already threatened there could be another one. Do we have any sense of how hard that has hit the US economy? I don't suppose there was any mention of it at this news conference, but clearly there are concerns about the damage that might have done.
Yes, over the period of a few weeks that the shutdown affected, Standard & Poor's, for example, have estimated the cost of the American economy was $6 billion. In an economy that's worth $19 trillion over the course of a whole year, that's not a huge impact, but there will be undoubtedly be individual businesses that, you know, that are dependent on selling stuff to federal employees that maybe may have taken a significant hit. So certainly it's an issue. And it's also an issue for the Fed in this sense, in that it has disrupted some of the data that they are dependent on. And one of the things Mr. Powell was very keen to emphasize was that their decisions are very much dependent on data. We should, earlier on Wednesday, have had the first estimate of the economic growth in the fourth quarter of the year. Well, it hasn't happened. It's now going to be delayed until February. And that does make it a little bit more difficult for the Fed to pilot its the US economy. It's not quite true to say that it's flying completely blind, but it does have a quite severely impaired vision until the federal agencies do manage to catch up on the data that's been delayed.
So, David, we finally got this sort of about term from the Federal Reserve. Was Singapore impressed?
Well, I think so. And I think, you know, the whole world will be impressed, Nigel. But I think, you know, what people are beginning to realize is that Jerome Powell, the Fed chair, is being asked to manage not only the U.S. economy, but the kind of the global economy, bird box style. In other words, I mean, he doesn't know what is actually in front of him at any point in time. And this is really the cross currents that he's talking about, because there is so much uncertainty. One minute, you think everything is going all right, and then all of a sudden you get these disputes appearing again between America and China. And this is causing a lot of problems for the Federal Reserve. And I think the other thing is quantitative tightening, or the reverse of quantitative easing, which is what we saw back in 2008 when Ben Bernanke started injecting all this money into the US and the global economy. They don't know how to take this money back. Yeah. I mean, the analogy
is...
Well,
Japan tried it, didn't they? And that didn't work.
Well, the thing is, quantitative easing has worked to some extent, because the amount of money that was created, not only by the U.S. Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, but also by the European Central Bank, the Bank of Japan, the People's Bank of China, the Bank of England. The amount of money that has been created has flooded global markets. Now they have to try and take this money back. And the analogy is like squeezing toothpaste out of a toothpaste tube. You get it out, but if you have too much, how do you put it back in the toothpaste again? And this is the problem that the Federal Reserve has. And what they're talking about in terms of running off this money or running off their balance sheet is to simply try and use whatever toothpaste is out there and hopefully that it doesn't sort of dry up too quickly so you can still have some kind of liquidity in the market. And this is the problem that the Federal Reserve has.
Thanks, David. Now, one of the world's top auditing firms has suffered the indignity of a $500,000 fine for its behaviour in Malaysia. Deloitte Malaysia was given the maximum penalty allowed by the Securities Commission there for breaches relating to a bond issued by 1MDB, which is a state investment fund overseen by the country's finance ministry, no less. Deloitte was found guilty of not immediately reporting irregularities with a bond, which may have had an effect on the ability to repay creditors. Deloitte has previously said it stands by its professionalism, its quality, independence and ethics, though it has made no further comment. Francine McKenna is a transparency reporter for MarketWatch.
Well, it's interesting. The Malaysia Securities Commission imposed this maximum fine of 2.2 million ringgit, which is, I've seen a translation of about $536,000. And it's really because they believe Deloitte failed in its duty to report some irregularities in this bond issue that now, significantly affected the accounts of 1MDB. And also that they delayed in filing the reports for these years with the Securities Commission. And so it's really, you know, sort of a negligence on multiple counts.
Now, this state fund has been scandal-ridden. This is not the first time it's been in the news. But can you explain essentially what the auditors were accused of not flagging up?
So, as we know, One Malaysia Development Fund is a sovereign fund. Investments were made, and auditors are supposed to be looking at the accounts to determine whether or not they're accurately representing the information, in particular if the fund is issuing debt and whether or not they have the right enough resources in order to repay that debt. And what the securities regulator said was that Deloitte did not gather enough evidence to determine whether or not advances to 1MDB the proceeds from this bond issue would be able to be recovered. In other words, they didn't do enough work to make sure that all of the details were in line. And now there's concerns that this is going to severely impact their ability to repay this debt.
So what you're implying is this doesn't draw a line under this affair. There is reputational damage and issues which will continue to need investigating?
Certainly. And, you know, and as we know, Deloitte was the third auditor to be involved. And so one after another auditor either raised issues or looked and said, wow, this is just too risky. So Deloitte is sort of the last one here left holding the bag. They resigned in 2016, but that doesn't mean that they're not still held responsible for financial statements that they issued with their opinion in 2013 and 2014 that now are seen to be completely inadequate.
It has to be said the fine is relatively small compared to the amount of money which is involved or could still be missing.
Sure, and I think that that's because, in general, regulators around the world that regulate the accounting firms sort of don't anticipate that they should take significant responsibility in these issues. They're often given sort of a pass in terms of, you know, whether they can find or whether they can identify frauds, especially when they're criminal frauds, collusive frauds. And so they can fine them only for sort of not doing their job, not following the procedures, not ticking all the boxes. But unless they can prove that the audit firm was part of the collusion, part of the criminal conspiracy, I think that they would be sort of reluctant to do anything other than sort of a slap on the wrist.
Francine McKenna. So, David, I mean, this is tricky in a way because the extent of the auditor's culpability can be discussed all night, but it doesn't actually solve, you know, where the problem originated from.
Well, Nigel, I feel sorry for Deloitte and I feel sorry for any auditor that had to have a look at the accounts of 1MDB. I mean, my son is an accountant and he said to me once, if a company wants to defraud its stakeholders, what is the auditor supposed to do? There is only so much forensic investigation that any auditor can do. And in this particular case, when the ruling party, the Barisan National, has been in power for 60 years and they are in control of 1MDB, and you think that they are going to be in power forever, and a lot of people didn't expect a turnaround in the government, well, you would just sign off those accounts. Because, I mean, if the executives of 1MDB says, this is the information, this is all I'm going to give you, then you have to work with that. So you just add up the numbers and you go, right, okay, you know, the numbers are fine. How much time are you going to spend forensically investigating every single piece of invoice in there? It's almost impossible for them to do. So
it's almost I wonder if it's almost the same as, I don't know, Google operating in a country which has different values. I mean, maybe the auditor should just say, I don't want anything to do with this job. It's a big issue. We'll I'm sure return to it shortly. Just to remind you, you're listening to Business Matters here on the BBC World Service with me, Nigel Cassidy. You're welcome back to Business Matters with me, Nigel Cassidy. Now, coping with extreme weather is a fact of life in many parts of the world, and some of us, dare I say, cope better than others. The British transport system, for example, can and does grind to a halt faced with the wrong kind of snow. The United States Midwest is more used to bad winters, but yet even accurate weather forecasts there can hardly prepare people for the so-called polar vortex freeze. This is a stream of air which usually spins around the stratosphere over the North Pole, but has been diverted, bringing temperatures lower than Antarctica and all but shutting down cities. At least 7 people have been known to have died. 90 million people are said to be experiencing temperatures of minus 17 and in some places up to minus 30 degrees Celsius. Well, Karen Johnson's a reporter with WLWT-TV in the city of Cincinnati, Ohio. So just how cold is it?
As soon as you breathe the cold air in, you could just feel it go through your entire body. And just being outside, you know, I've had my thumbs outside of my mittens just so I could take pictures and tweet and do everything that's required of my job. And just within 30 seconds, the tips of my fingers are numb.
Apparently, you can get frostbite within 10 minutes. You presumably not tested that.
No, I am not going to test that. Luckily, we have a heated news van. So we'll go out, do an interview, hop back, warm up, go back out. And I have to tell you, something that has been a lifesaver for us today are those bathrooms with the really strong hand dryers. So we've been popping in those bathrooms and just sticking our hands underneath the hand dryers. And that's been a lifesaver.
So what sort of a sense of a normal life is there where you are? Are people still getting to school or work, or are they just holed up?
No, actually, all of the school districts in the area, I believe it's over 100 school districts in the area, including the Cincinnati Public Schools, which is the biggest, they all closed today. And we're just getting notifications that schools are starting to close for tomorrow as well. The United States Postal Service stopped delivering mail today in our area. When you're driving the streets, it feels like it's a holiday. There are not many cars out there on the roads.
Now, you're an important area for business and industry. Are companies managing to deliver the goods and go about their business?
I've seen trucks out. It seems like the big corporations, the big trucks, the UPS trucks, they're still doing what they have to do. The Uber drivers, I'm pretty sure they're probably busy today for people who don't want to drive. Also, the Amazon, my photographer was just, he has that Ring doorbell, and he was saying that, oh, look, my package got delivered. So there are still people out working just like us. We've been out following the dog warden around, and he's been going out checking on animals. And believe it or not, people are leaving their animals out on this which is just horrible to see. The dogs, the one dog that we saw was dancing around. You could tell his poor paws were just frozen. The ice, the water buckets that were left out for him, frozen solid. So we're seeing a lot of, you know, things we wish we didn't have to see.
And how accurately was it forecast? Were people ready for this?
I think they were. The meteorologists here locally and I think nationally were dead on. They were saying, you know, that it was going to feel like 15, 20, 30 degrees below. And that's what it is right now. -2 where I am without the wind chill. And that's what they were forecasting. So they got this one right.
That's Karen Johnson trying to keep warm with the hand dryer. Well, Maya Van Rossum is in New York, not quite as cold as Cincinnati, I don't think. Of course, famously, President Trump suggested America needs a bit of global warming to kind of make up for all this cold, whereas I guess most school children would tell him that's actually the cause of it.
Exactly. Even the school children understand that climate change is real and that these extremes that we're experiencing are very scary in terms of what they bode for the future. You know, today we have these record cold, but yet over the past year, we've had reporting about the record-breaking heat that communities were experiencing. So I think both of these extremes and some of them just happening days apart for some communities is really making the reality of climate change hit home. And it's quite frightening for people. And it's frightening for school children, and it should be frightening for Donald Trump.
OK, thanks, Maya. More from her and from David shortly. But let's just continue this theme of weather for a bit, because it got us thinking about all those weather apps that you can get. Obviously, Americans can keep up with what's going on with their weather, but the apps often don't agree, even though they draw on the same data. So how come is that, we wonder? Well, Nick Fleming's a science journalist based here in the UK, and he's looked into the business of forecasting now that we're all using these apps.
Yes, there are thousands of weather apps that people use, and it's completely changed how people get their weather forecasts and what they expect from weather forecasting, and it changes the way people use weather forecasting to plan what they're doing, whether that's their social life or professionally and economically.
But what you've discovered is that there's more disparity than we might think between one app and another. And in some cases, that does raise quite a few issues.
Well, I think a lot of people have the experience of checking the weather on more than one apps and being a little bemused by finding they're being given different messages by different forecasting services. But when we look at how these forecasts are generated in a little more detail, it's not that surprising that they are producing different forecasts. All the different companies will be using different algorithms. They'll be having different sets of data put in there. They'll be measuring over different timescales. And once you factor that in, it's not that surprising that these different apps will spit out different predictions.
You actually found some organisations that were consistently more gloomy about the weather data they were looking at, and that led to a bad advanced forecast, if you like. And then people were complaining. Tell me more about that.
Well, there was a phenomenon that is less fashionable now in forecasting called wet bias. And certainly something that I used to notice was that if I checked, for example, the BBC weather app, I would often find that you would look at the different icons, and if there was one little grey one, it would, the overall icon for that day would be rain. And so this tendency, I think, was down to the fact that if you're going out for the day and you're told it's probably going to rain and you take your umbrella and it's sunny, then that's less bad for the weather user than the reverse, which is I go out with my sun cream and my shorts and it rains on me. So I think the thinking was, from the forecasting perspective, was to err on the side of the pessimistic. These days, forecasters are moving away from that kind of that wet bias approach towards more of a sort of probabilistic percentage chance of rain approach.
But I think there was an example of a tourist authority on the south coast of Britain actually demanding that the forecast be made more optimistic because they were losing actual business. People just weren't turning out. So, I mean, there is a case for optimistic weather in economic terms, if not in accuracy terms.
Yeah, I mean, it was a famous case in Bournemouth on a Saturday spring bank holiday, and it was predicting storms and lots of people didn't turn out on that bank holiday. As it happened, there was sunshine and blue skies and some very angry tourism managers and shop owners who felt lots more visitors would have come their way had it not been for the forecast.
Are there any ways of actually checking the accuracy of one app against another over time?
The difficulty is it does very much come down to what it is you are measuring. There are so many different things you can measure. It's very hard to come up with one particular lead table. I mean, they do try to do that, but it's a composite measure of accuracy, of precipitation, of wind speed, of sunshine. Are you looking at one day, 5 day, which locations, over what time period? So yes, people do come up with league tables, but there's always arguments over which measurements should be being used.
That is Nick Fleming, who is a science journalist. Well, Dr. David Kuo is still with us from the Motley Fool in Singapore. Well, I suppose it would be a pool if there's a lot of global warming. But what is your sense of how the sort of climate story is kind of developing?
Well, you know, Nigel, I'm one of these people who believe that it is better to be roughly right than precisely wrong. And so if a weather forecaster says to me that there is a 20% chance of rain, then I'll err on the side of caution and I'll take my umbrella out with me. But here in Singapore, I mean, the temperature is constant throughout the entire year. And you have no idea how relieved I am to be in Singapore when I hear about that cold weather in Cincinnati. I mean, over here, it's 30 degrees constantly. But we do have a binary option. It either rains or it doesn't rain. And so there is a 50-50 chance. And generally, the weather forecasters say there is a 50% chance of rain, which is precisely what.
Does that mean
you'd
never make
like
any money selling a weather app, that there isn't enough variety in the weather?
Probably not. But we do have a look to see what the weather is like outside. We do have an app, believe it or not, at certain times of the year that tells us about the air quality. And because previously there used to be all of this burning of forests out in Indonesia and all that, and it would cause this haze. So we have an app that sort of tells us how good the air quality is. And that is one, you know, that will probably sort of make people some money. But as far as predicting the weather is concerned, I can tell you it is going to be 30 degrees today, Nigel, and there is a 50% chance of rain.
So, Maya, do you use weather apps?
Yes, I do. And I can tell you, whether I'm getting my weather news from the television or from an app, I can always count on it to more times than not be wrong. As the leader of a nonprofit organization, I've had many a fundraiser ruined by a bad forecast predicting rain when we had beautiful sun. And in fact, just today, in the Northeast, there were these dire predictions of a snow squall, and people looked out the window and saw blustering snow, and daycare centers and others were closing because of the fear of the snow. Well, the snow squall was gone in 10 minutes, but you had a lot of very unhappy parents that had to rush out, right, to rescue their young children because they no longer had daycare. And that was all due to a weather prediction from an app.
Okay, well, ask for your money back. Maya, you did touch on this earlier, but you say that you think there is a greater awareness among Americans about the causes of extreme weather.
Absolutely. Despite what, you know, Donald Trump says, he does not represent Americans. And if you look at the polling, if you have conversations with people, it is demonstrated time and time again, more than 70% of the population in the U.S. knows that climate change is real and knows that people are a principal cause of the climate instability that we're experiencing. And they are getting active, calling for change from our elected leaders, but also implementing changes at their own homes. I mean, the number of people I see putting solar panels on their roofs or geothermal in their ground is just growing exponentially. And if you look at the numbers, the solar industry in the U.S. was up 13% last year, despite that the battle that we're having with China is the trade battle is actually resulting in higher prices on things like solar.
And probably also worth pointing out, David Kuo, that there are a lot of companies that process and sell weather data. And it's incredibly important for industry, isn't it, to know what's coming up, because it affects how you can move goods around, what you're going to sell.
Oh, you're absolutely right. I mean, it does have an environmental impact. I mean, on a small scale, I mean, Maya was absolutely right, you know, about people organizing events, and even on a even smaller scale, you know, would be people saying, I'm going to have a barbecue tonight. You know, how is the weather going to affect my social event today? And I think, you know, when you multiply that across the whole world, it will have an impact. But one of the best forecasters I have for whether it's going to rain or not is the gardener that actually tends to the shrubs and the lawns in my complex. And he says, if I water the plants in the morning, you are guaranteed to have rain in the afternoon, because as luck would have it, it will rain as soon as I water the plants. And so I think, you know, people have to be aware that weather is changing significantly, and it will have an environmental impact, and it will have an impact on the production costs and also the transportation costs for these businesses.
Do you think there's still a slight sense that we can either be responsible about these things, or we can carry on and make money? I mean, are there sufficient companies that are doing the right thing and profitable?
Well, I think, you know, people will just probably go towards the ones that are generally correct, and they will say those are the ones we tend to use. Maybe the best solution, Nigel, is for all of us to buy ourselves a barometer. You know, my mother used to tap on the barometer every morning and sort of say, David, it's going to rain this afternoon, so can you take your raincoat and galoshes out with you? And
do people really wear galoshes, David?
I recognize a galosh if it bit me on the arm. Have no idea how old I am, Nigel.
Dr. David Gray there from Motley Fool Singapore, and we also have from Maya Van Rossum. You're listening to Business Matters. Now it's time to find out what business stories are gripping other parts of the globe now. The BBC's Raoul Tandon joins us live from Kolkata. And, I gather the talk is all about books at the moment.
It is indeed, but you know what? Going back to your weather forecasting apps, I think if you had an app here this morning in Kolkata, it would tell you we won't see the sun because it's all pollution, pollution, pollution. But people are in a good mood here because the world's biggest public book fair will begin in a few hours' time. How big is it? Tridib Chatterjee is the man who organises. Have a listen to this.
The number of participants is 1,000. In Bengali books, Hindi books, the vernacular other language books, books from Bangladesh, books from France, books from UK.
And you have a huge number of people who visit every year.
Yes, last year it was 2 million in 12 days of time. And we expect more this year.
That's this new book fair, which is exciting, interesting, Kolkata, and we're talking to Raoul Tandon about it. Why this growth in demand for traditional books?
It's a good question, you know, because in many other parts of the world we see bookshops shutting down. In parts of India we see them opening up. I think there are two factors here. First is increasing literacy rates. More people have the ability to read in India every year, and so there is a growing demand for books. Also, we're seeing a huge growth in the vernacular. You know, traditionally here in India, it was a status symbol to have an English novel under your arm. People would feel that you would feel that people thought you were upwardly mobile. But there's been a massive increase in books in different languages, and that's what you're going to find at the book fair, like books in Bengali, in Hindi, in Tamil, in all the different languages that India has. And I still think there is a culture, particularly in the east of India, of reading books. I've been speaking to people here in Kolkata about their love for them.
Book is the best friend of mine, which demands nothing and complains nothing. So it's always stay forever with you. So that is why book is very important in my life, on everyone's life, I think so.
Our children are rich with books. Books are, you have to read books. That's like a daily meal you have to have.
Here the people have a special feeling towards the books. They love the smell of the books, actually. So they buy old books, new books.
Interesting to hear all that, because in many parts of the world, the Kindle book or the e-reader have become very popular. And one time, well, as those bookshops closed, people were kind of forecasting that the traditional book with pages that you pick up would disappear. So is there much penetration of the e-book there in India?
You know, it's beginning to happen. As we see the growth of the internet in this country, the growth of the smartphone as well, there is no doubt that we are beginning to see a slight change, but not the change that we're seeing in other parts of the world. And I suppose it's that cultural factor, isn't it? If as a child you've got used to the smell of the book that somebody talked about there, holding a book in your hand, then I think here people still prefer that. This is a place, you know, I'm on a street in Kolkata. If I look a bit further down, every morning on the walls, they glue on the newspapers so people can read them. That is the culture here. It's a culture where people still want to read. They prefer the book in the hand. Who knows, with the internet growing, though, maybe in a few years' time, we won't have 2 million people at the Kolkata Book Fair, maybe only 1.5 million.
Raoul Tandon talking to us live from Kolkata. Now, well, we could kind of stay with communication, slightly different form, with the worth of many antiques, like old furniture and curios, falling. It's rather pleasing to discover there's one collectible that's fast becoming more valuable. It is the typewriter. The first commercially successful model was invented in the United States back in 1867. These clattery devices giving out a satisfying ping when you got to the end of a line were once the tool of choice in offices everywhere. In their heyday in the 1950s and 60s, there were hundreds of typewriter makers with factories all over the world, including Remington in the US, Adler in Germany, and Imperial in the UK. And Underwood, that's the one that I remember. It was the computer age which proved to be the typewriter's nemesis, but as our Mike Johnson reports, some people have been rediscovering the typewriter's virtues.
This is an Olympia, German manufactured. I think just after the war, apparently the...
Alan Hurst in his typewriter shop in Brick Lane in the heart of London's East End. Alan has just turned 80. He's been a typewriter engineer for 60 years and counting.
Computers, they've got no character, have they? They just sort of sit there. But these you can put a piece of paper in and type away. I just like the look of them and the way they sound. They sound... different.
And it's also the feel of these things. It's a mechanical thing. The way they feel under your fingers.
That's exactly, yeah, exactly. It's just a delight to use them, really.
Alan and his metal machines aren't ready to be consigned to the history books just yet. His business is thriving, with record sales over the festive period. Alan's reconditioned manual typewriters typically sell for anything between $50 and $500. His customers don't always want to use them, of course. They might just want to look at them, proudly displaying their new vintage asset in the living room or home office. Either way, typewriters do seem to be striking a chord with a whole new generation. Ten-year-old Conrad Barker lives in Walthamstow, a northeastern suburb of London. He loves to bash out stories on his family's recently bought Olympia Monica Deluxe. Conrad's specialism is terror.
Don't stay up late or he will get you. By Conrad the Bard.
That's you.
Yeah, that's me. Thomas was 8 years old and he lived in a house in the countryside with his mum and dad and baby brother Alex. Thomas didn't really have any friends at school. And then there's like a guy who kills you if you don't go to sleep.
And it's in red. You've typed this up in red, I can see. Why do you do it in red? Is that extra frightening?
Yeah, it just makes it scarier, like blood. I like the sound it makes when you tap. Yeah, it's more fun than a computer.
It's not more fun than a Nintendo or an Xbox, though, is it? Come on.
No, it's not.
That might be asking a little too much of a technology born more than a century and a half ago. The last typewriter factory in the world, in Mumbai, closed its doors in 2011, although manual typewriters remain a part of everyday life for many people in India. Conrad's mum, Irena, though, a journalist specialising in education, believes every school today should have a manual typewriter because it's proved so useful to Conrad and his brother and sister.
The kids love sticking a bit of paper in and sending it through. I mean, you can do that all afternoon. And it's as simple as that. You can literally start typing straight away. I've been so pleased with some of the stuff they've produced. Previously, they were a little bit uptight about writing at home. I'd say, come on, why don't you write about how you're feeling today? No, Mama, I'm not too sure. I can't write. It just gives children and young people a different way to express themselves and just be more creative, leave the classroom behind, leave tech behind, leave handwriting practice behind, and just it's a new way to channel their thoughts and their creativity.
Mike Johnson reporting. So, were we talking about books earlier? I mean, actual physical books, and now the typewriter, both analogue machines. We're now in a digital age. I suppose, David Kuo, I can't quite imagine you bringing out the latest edition of The Motley Fool by sort of typing it all up, but perhaps you might just remember them?
I certainly can remember them. I've had the whole range of typewriters, you know, from the standard typewriter all the way up to the golf ball typewriter. But I tell you one thing about typewriting, and that is that it's not the typing that's the problem. It's actually the correction afterwards when you read it through and you have to bring out the correction fluid and you end up sort of painting. That sheet of paper weighed more at the end of typing than it did at the beginning because of the weight of correction fluid. I had to actually paint over all the words.
Maybe as a writer, you had to be sort of clearer because you couldn't keep changing what you were going to say. So maybe it was writing was a sort of different process. Meyer, I'm guessing perhaps you don't remember typewriters, but
are you kidding me? Holy crow! You know, and I will say, David is spot on. The only problem with the typewriter is the correcting. And I am very excited because I actually saw my old electric typewriter up in our attic a few months back. Yep. And after this story, I'm excited to bring it down from the attic and share it with my kids because typing on a typewriter is definitely more satisfying than on a computer keyboard.
Do you still have a ribbon on an electric one? Because that was always the problem. The ribbons, you couldn't get them or they go out of alignment or something.
Yeah, no, there was like a cartridge that I would put in, right? And then you could also automatically correct. But I didn't have red. I would love to have.
Well, that's like shouting. That's like typing in capitals, isn't it? Having red.
Yeah, you can't really bold on a typewriter either, but. Which is necessary for shouting.
And just briefly, that previous story we were talking about, the physical book, does that still exist in your world, Maya?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, I am going to be taking my fourth trip to India, my favorite country to travel to. It's where I was born. And normally I take pencils to share with the children. But I think now I'm going to bring some extra books, children's books that I can leave behind in the hotels and in the towns. I love reading books and I love real books as opposed to the electronic machine types. And I'm going to really enjoy sharing them with the children next year when I go back to India.
I'm guessing, David, the electronic version is probably a bit more popular in Singapore.
Well, yes, but I tell you the big problem with trying to sort of read things using a electronic medium like an iPad. The temperature is so hot here that quite often your machine will just overheat out in the heat and they'll say, right, you know, that's it. You can't do any more.
Thanks so very much for both of you. That's it from Business Matters. See you again soon.